infection prevention is systemically relevant, and it's not only something of some experts. It needs to be in the heart of society, because our society cannot run if there is a pandemic. It's not just one more medical part. It's more than medical, and it affects so many different aspects that we need to think about that. And a university, as the name says, wants to bring all the knowledge together.
It's the 15th of May, 2020, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration. And we're doing a special series on the COVID-19 crisis and looking at how that's playing out in different countries around the world. I'm doing this with my co-host, Abby Steele, and it's been 2 weeks since we chatted, and I have lots of banter, lots of big changes in my house. The first thing is, like, my son finally got to go to school. He turned 4, which is the official age for schooling in the Netherlands. And so yesterday was his first day at school, and I think it was actually better to do it. I think it was better to do it under these terms. Like, you're not actually allowed to go to the class with him, and he just has to go in by himself. And so he doesn't know any different. But the odd thing was, like, actually not the children. The children were fine. It was all the parents. And like all of us who kind of like each other, right? Like, and our friends, and none of us knew how to really socially interact without like the deep feeling that we needed cuddles, right? Like that, you know, that how do you see someone after such a long period of time and then stay 2 meters apart? That was hard.
Yeah. I had the same this morning at the school drop off. I was really, really trying to hug my friend Boucher, like, from far away, like, oh,
Boucher. So that sucks. And so that brings me to my second announcement, which is because of the lack of cuddles, we have gotten what's called an isopet, which is our new dog, Spikey, a massive bulldog. I'm going to post photos to the blog. And she is filling also that massive gap of lack of affection and contact in our lives at the moment, which is helping. Yeah. That's me.
I can't wait to huge snuggle with Spikey also.
Yeah. You can get vicarious. onto the podcast, Abby, you're going to introduce, thankfully, our next guest, another awesome colleague of ours, who is also not with us anymore, Sijon Ling. I'll let you do it, Abby.
Okay, great. So I'm really delighted that we're able to talk to Sijon Lim this morning. And she is now working in Seoul as an assistant professor in the Division of International Studies at Korea University. But we used to have her at the University of Amsterdam. And she studies comparative welfare politics, especially in developing economies in particular. And so she's going to talk to us today about how things have been going in South Korea. And welcome, Sijon. It's so nice to be chatting with you.
Nice talking to you. So thanks for inviting me. And when it comes to the general situation here in South Korea, I should say that we are indeed in a much better position than where we were in March, when there was a massive outbreak from, as you might know, this religious community, which worried not just Koreans, but people from across the world. And since then, I think things have been managed pretty well by the government and by the people. And now, as of mid-May, we're in a much better position than we were in March, but also in a much better position than the rest of the world, than many European countries and compared to the US. So generally, people have been very positive about how the government has handled the crisis. And we're also pretty much in compliance with what the measures that the government tried to employ. Until, I guess, a couple of weeks ago, when we had a smaller scale second wave of outbreak started from clubs and bars in Seoul. So we, I think, have more than 100 cases related to the clubs and bars. And that worries a lot of people, actually, because we will be opening up schools and kids will go back to school again next week. So people are generally positive, but at the same time worried that this last minute people being relaxed, loosen up, kind of can cause a second massive wave of outbreak. So people are trying not to make that happen.
And just for our listeners' sake, Sijung, so the idea that you could have clubs and bars open at all in Amsterdam is anathema to us. So maybe you can describe what the conditions of the lockdown or the measures taken by the government were and why these sorts of places would have ordinarily been open.
So South Korea actually had never were in the large scale official lockdown or stay home order kind of environment. So people were free to go where they want. So the government, of course, recommended not to have meetings of more than a certain size, not to go to church, not to go to clubs and bars, but those were mainly recommendations. So it wasn't a mandatory thing that people had to follow, like in some European countries where you could only go out once in a day to this kind of thing. So we never had it, actually.
But what about when someone got sick? Because there, I think, in contrast to here, it sounds like almost the inverse, where the government here can close whole sectors, but when someone gets sick, then they just sort of recommend that they quarantine themselves, and there's not really kind of strict monitoring of that. How is the quarantining enforced, or is it not, in South Korea?
So for those people who actually were found to be exposed to someone who's confirmed or who were coming from overseas, for those specific situations, the government mandates 2 weeks self-quarantine period. And for those type of people, I think the monitoring has been pretty strong. And yeah, it was to an extent that once you violate the sort of self-quarantine, the mandatory self-quarantine for a specific type of population, not for the entire population, for this small group of population, if you violate once, you might have to wear this electric bracelet kind of thing that you normally use on sex offenders. So yeah, this caused some controversy, but then yeah, I guess it was okay for Koreans to sacrifice a bit of the liberty side of your yeah. rights in this case.
Could you also describe, I mean, one of the things in relation to that is the issue of privacy and the track and tracing of people who have been either exposed or have been diagnosed to have coronavirus. And in this case, I mean, that was particularly sensitive, as I understand it, given that this was a series of clubs used by Korea's LGBTQ community, who, for various reasons, right, obviously have a little bit more of an uncertainty and caution when it comes to governments taking large amounts of information about their contact lists and where they were and whether they were at a gay club, essentially.
So to just give you a brief summary of what happened is that, as you said, the recent outbreak, relatively small-scale outbreak, happened, it was got to know, we don't actually know where that it originated from there, but it was found from some of the people who went to the clubs and bars and areas where the LGBT communities are concentrated, so the clubs and bars for the LGBTQ community. So people were naturally worried in a culturally conservative setting like Korea that people wouldn't really come out to get tested, even though they knew that they were in contact with these confirmed people, and they knew that they have certain symptoms that are related to the virus.
Yeah.
So the government initially contacted using the list of cell phone numbers that they actually used to enter the club, because that was the thing that government required. If you can open it, but then you still need to provide the list of people who used the facilities. But of course, a lot of
and you don't um you don't need to provide or authorize the government to take that information, right? They just simply have the prerogative to do so. Is that correct?
It's not, yeah. So they were recommended to have it. It might actually be that they had to have it. But the thing is that you could provide fake information, right, on those lists. So it turned out that a lot of people provided false information. So what the government did was that they used the mobile phone stations. How do you say? Yep. Yeah. To track
mobile towers.
Yeah, the towers to track those people who were in the neighborhood for over 30 minutes during the specific time period and were identified thousands of people, and then started contacting them and then try to make them come out by assuring them that your personal information wouldn't be revealed. So now what the government is doing, because they understand this privacy considerations, especially for the LGBTQ community, they are giving numbers when they come to the testing station instead of writing down their names, where they live, what they do, which is normally what the testing stations would do for other people. So they're just given numbers and they just become this area patient 60, something like that. So an anonymous testing is going on.
That sounds like an interesting kind of compromise, but also like a veiled sort of threat. Like, if you don't come forward, we might announce your name or something. Was there fear of this kind of information somehow being public in spite of the government's promises, or as a tool that the government could threaten these people with?
So the city of Seoul or the government, the central government, have never officially used that coercive tactic of like threatening to reveal your identity. That wouldn't, that has never happened. But I think people, just by seeing that how easily the government can get this sort of information by soliciting cooperation from these big mobile companies, how easily the government can get your private information might have scared people and had an impact on them voluntarily showing up. Yeah, but then the government didn't make that kind of threat, fortunately.
I'm interested because there's a certain parallel between both of the major flare-ups in South Korea's sort of story of this case, and one is that both of the communities, the religious community and also the LGBTQ community, have reasons to have a certain withdrawal or secrecy around their activities and not to provide information. I wonder whether you can speak at all to that analogy and whether there's been any sort of stigmatization of the religious grouping because of their role and responsibility, and how that then plays into the perception of what's happening in these nightclubs.
It's interesting because it could actually have been any group that is identifiable as a group who could have been stigmatized, right? In this case, it was a religious community. But then some people would also blame where a lot of these religious the city where these religious communities were, a lot of them were living. And I think the same for the LGBTQ community. It could have been this community, LGBTQ community, but it could have been any like migrant community, any like outgroup in terms of ethnicity, race. So I think this is interesting. And as you said, Darshan, there is indeed a parallel there, that a group that kind of sees themselves as minority of any sort could have this magnified stigmatization when it comes to this sort of crisis.
In the Netherlands also, I think, you know, there's been a lot of fretting about privacy and sort of what approach, you know, I think in general the government is coming around to the idea that contact tracing is really necessary to keep infections at a manageable level if we're going to have a more open, you know, not a total lockdown. but they really struggle with how are we going to do this in a way that won't scare people. And I just wonder if in South Korea there has been, I'm really sorry, everyone around me is engaging in home improvements. So
we're not hearing it that much, though. It's just fine. Drilling. We're not. We're okay.
But what I was going to say is that in South Korea, I wonder, is there any discussion of concerns like this about privacy? I mean, maybe in relation to the possible stigmatization you just mentioned, but also maybe just on an individual level, are there discussions like this in the media or with the political parties? Or,
well, I shouldn't generalize too much, but what I see from just major media outlets or just based on my conversation with people around me, there is, I think, surprisingly little discussion on privacy. There is a surprisingly high level of support for what the government has done to trace these people, because I think a lot of people agree that this is a unique situation, that public health is at risk, public order is at risk, and I think a lot of Koreans value this collective security. Could be human security, could be actual security, this collective sense of like being secure a lot. So I think at this moment, that concern outweighs this concern for privacy or your freedom and liberty. And this might, this weighing of two values, your public, your community's health and order and safety, as opposed to your personal freedom and liberty, the way how Koreans weigh the two might be, in a sense, different from how Europeans or Americans might, yeah, see them.
I'm really curious about now, how the government is trying to generate some kind of trust too. So you had this kind of learning experience, but also you had this, a relatively massive movement in the last couple of years that led to the ousting of the former president. So that's a sort of big deal in any democratic country. And can you find any connections for us between that sort of mass mobilization and political transition and sort of how the government, the new government that came on the heels of that has managed this crisis? Or, you know, if the fact that a sort of popular uprising led to the current government in power, do you think it has any relationship with how willing people are to listen to them or anything like that?
I don't know. Here I also shouldn't just try to make an association or a causal relationship, but, well, I don't know if I can trace the relationship back to the candlelight movement or the ousting of the past president, but I think I can still say that the popularity of the president helps at the moment, how people perceive and respond to the guidelines of the government.
Yeah.
And also the fact that the government has managed pretty well the crisis and won the election recently. Mm. Also, I think empowers the government a lot compared to some other countries who are going through this crisis but under a very weak and unpopular government. So yeah. The government.
How recent were the elections?
Hmm?
How recent were they? For our listeners, how recent were the elections?
It was just last month.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and so that's another fascinating element of this. Not only is South Korea containing the disease so much better than so many other countries, but you also were able to hold elections where the turnout was historically high, right? Where you have other examples of countries sort of using this as an excuse or can't figure out, at least in my own country, right? In different states, right? They cannot figure out how to hold elections safely, so they're just delaying them, which, yeah. So can you talk a little bit about how the government managed to hold the elections, and why you think so many people turned out in spite of, you know, the ongoing risks?
So the government, I think, was able to manage the election despite the crisis because we have a pretty easygoing pre-voting system. So we don't have this pre-register system that you have in the US, for instance. People can just vote without any pre-registration before the official election date. And this time the period they could have voted was pretty long. So people could come not just all at the same time, but when they wanted and feel more secure, because if they could only vote on a day or in 2 days, then people would naturally worry that I might get exposed to virus when, well, I was in the voting station, right? So that worry, technically speaking, was able to be mitigated because of the system. And then I think people actually turned out more than they usually do. The turnout was record high, I heard. I think maybe there are two reasons, but these are just my speculation. One is this traditional rallying around the flag thing. When the country is in crisis, they, well, Abby, probably you're an expert in this. People try to support the incumbent who's fighting against an enemy, but now this enemy is not a traditional enemy, but a virus, but still the government is fighting for the country, and this, in this adverse environment, we should be all behind this government. So maybe this crisis sentiment kind of increased the turnout and also was kind of in, worked in favor of the government, the current government. But I was also speculating that this positive spotlight that Korea received, especially what Abby just said, how Korea didn't postpone the election. It was like the symbol of democracy still strong and steady in spite all this happening. And this is probably, my country is the only country that is holding this election in schedule, so people kind of enjoyed this spotlight, and I think this positive attention might have had a positive impact on their own civic engagement. So things like voting and things like political participation. Although this is only a speculation, but then because it was covered a lot in the domestic media, citing actually foreign media, so they, it's kind of nice thing to hear, right? How BBC and CNN says nice things about my election. It kind of encourages me to participate as a citizen in the election. So that might be another explanation.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think it's also just really refreshing to hear that a government was committed to encouraging participation and it seems and taking measures that enable that, where, you know, the incumbents in countries like my own clearly don't want mass participation, right? They want to try to disenfranchise certain sectors of the population, which is, you know, not great. But it's also not new historically in our country. So it's great to hear also that Korea is going the opposite route with registration, like same day registration and more convenient times for voting in general, you know?
I mean, it's revealing like how bizarre the United States and its politicization of voting itself, right, is in this context. And that, you know, this stuff should be something that is relatively neutrally accepted across society and not so deeply politicized in terms of access, right?
Yeah, I mean, just historically from the get-go, we had problems with labor franchise, as you know, and... it continues. It's just in a different form. And even, you know, voting days are not holidays in the US and we don't vote on weekends. Mm. So any sort of push to making voting easier is against the status quo. And that's a problem, right? We should be starting from the other way around. But anyway, we don't have to talk about the pathologies of the US because we will go on forever.
One of the things I'm interested also to know and hear about in terms of just how people are responding to it is, so the one thing that we all fear, I guess, at the moment is over the next 18 months of this sort of suppress and release, you know, on off measures. And I guess you're now in a phase, I think, where you're going back into some more strict controls. Like, I heard that the bars and clubs are now being closed in certain parts of Seoul, if not all of Seoul. How are people responding to that, you know, psychologically? Because I think if we feel after lifting that we're going back into what we've just had, that there will be a lot more antipathy, a lot more unwillingness to perhaps comply. I would want to hear about it in the South Korean context.
I think overall people have shown a great willingness to comply. But then again, I shouldn't generalize, right? Because it's, I would say, a relatively small segment of the society who regularly go to clubs, right? In this area where the clubs are now shut down. So people would generally think that this doesn't really affect me. And also, I think if people say, or the government say, or the majority says, this is for the public health and public security, I think Korean people in general will be on board with it. So they wouldn't really express a dissenting idea. They would tend to go with what the majority says is for the social good. So they, in a sense, like, people are very sensitive to the social context. So if the situation is like this, it shouldn't be worse because we should be prepared for the schools opening up next week. So if this is the sentiment, people will generally be fine with it. And even though there might be, of course, people who are against it, they wouldn't really be very vocal about that, at least publicly.
So I have a question related to schools, but not K through 12, but the university level. So I know your academic year just started recently, right?
We actually started mid-March, but only recently, okay. I think it was just last week that the university gave us an option to hold offline, the normal face-to-face classes, but if students, all of the students are on board with it, and if the class size is smaller than 30 people.
Okay, so smaller than 30 people, and would you have to be in a large room or something? Did they say what offline classes would have to look like in person, or?
In my university, the classroom has to be, so if I have a class size of 30, the classroom has to be the one that holds three times more than that, so 90.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it wasn't really because of the classroom issues that we are still remain mostly online. It's actually because when we voted in, so I'm teaching three classes now, one undergrad class and two graduate seminars. So because the university required us to get unanimous consent from students to move offline, I did this anonymous voting in all my classes. And it turned out that students also prefer staying online for a variety of reasons, So in one of my class, my undergrad class, which was only the size of 20, I thought that this class could move offline, but then 16 people voted no, and only four were willing to come back. So yeah, so we are.
Yeah,
you weren't even
decisive.
Close to a majority, right? Like that's overwhelming. I mean, what is your perception as to why? Is it health concerns? Is it this is a advantageous situation and I'm going to stick with it? You know, I don't know. Like, what do you think motivated those decisions? Because it's quite strong, 16 out of 20.
I think the biggest and most plausible reason, in my opinion, was because only small classes were allowed to make this transition. But undergrad students also take large classes, right? So for them, it's really inconvenient if they have to come to campus only to take my class, to participate in my class, and then go run home to participate in Zoom sessions and then come back for my session. So that's one reason that they actually told me. So if it was like a consistent measure that all courses are now offline, they would have enjoyed it. But if it's just one of my course, two of my course, it's just, it adds confusion. So
I'm curious about this, like in university life generally. I'm on a sort of chat group with people from ISA, and someone just put it out there and said, you know, anyone thinking about going to ISA in Las Vegas? And it was just like repeat after repeat, all of these different reasons for saying, like, you know, I don't trust airlines anymore, or like, I fear the health crisis, or I think this is irresponsible, or whatever. Lining up, there was not anyone saying, yay, gung-ho, I'm all for Las Vegas. And I'm wondering about that sort of feeling in terms of restarting, you know, our entire professional lives, like what that's going to look like.
I think it's so tricky. And yesterday, I don't know if you saw the news, Darshan, but there was apparently some decision taken by the government or the health ministry, a recommendation. I'm not sure what the status is, but that students won't be allowed to travel during rush hour on public transportation.
I saw this.
And I don't know until when, but a lot of colleagues were on Twitter complaining, like, of course, if you can't let them travel during rush hour, then we won't be able to teach them except for this very narrow window of the day in person. Yeah. But my reaction to the whole thing was like, oh, I have a lot of colleagues who really expect to teach in person in the fall, which I was like, this is not going to affect us. Like, I just don't see how it's going to happen. I don't know. Maybe I'm too pessimistic, but
yeah, I don't see it happening. Not in the way in which many people are expecting. Yeah.
Well, Sijung, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about what's going on in South Korea. Do you have any parting, like, wisdom for the rest of us who are in these, like, I want to say, like, on the verge of malfunctioning, but like, maybe we're still, let's say we're on the, like, back end of the learning curve, right? Like, we just are not really we're not really making it up this very steep incline as quickly as we would like. So from the other end of the learning curve, do you have any anything to help us?
Well, I don't think so, because it's so unpredictable still, right? I'm now saying that we're doing much better than before, much better than this European countries, but who knows? And that's how I think what I learned, right?
I mean, is there not even any South Korean gloating at this, like looking at other countries and going like, what are you doing? I know in New Zealand, for example, them looking at Australia, there's a lot of that going on, like, come on, you know, supposed to be the big brother, but not really.
Well, Koreans always like to be compared with Japan, but
yeah, that's what I was wondering.
There some gloating there now? Is there some enjoyment to the fact that Japan is a bit, let's say, less certain of how things are going?
Japan is not that horrible, right? In a sense, it's not so like managing, but I have this is also my purely personal opinion, but Koreans tend to kind of exaggerate how Japan is struggling. And I think that's what, we normally do. Not just Koreans, like each side kind of enjoy doing that when one side is in trouble.
Well, to me, what it seems like is that, like, one major advantage that South Korea seems to have, to me, not only, of course, the absolute number of deaths is so much lower, but you also, seem to know a lot more, right? Just the idea that you can identify where this most recent outbreak happened is so above and beyond what other countries are able to do right now. I mean, holding aside the questions of like how you find those people, right? But just being able to say, okay, this is a potentially really problematic outbreak situation. You know, Japan also is not in a position to do that right now. They just aren't. They're not testing on the same level, right, as South Korea. So I don't think, even though they're relatively better than a lot of other countries, the amount of, like, the sense of how much control that they have over monitoring the situation strikes me as quite different.
Yeah, a lot of people from outside would think that we have similar political culture, Korea and Japan. But what I see, I'm not an expert in Japanese political.
We want your personal opinion, Sijung. Just let loose.
Japan seems to be much more individualistic and put less emphasis compared to Korea on solidarity and this kind of civic engagement in a collective sense than Korea. Mm-hmm. So it has like upsides and downsides. But then I think when it comes to this sort of crisis, maybe it was easier for a Korean government to mobilize Koreans to be on board with this sort of track and trace system and do quarantine and do the self-report things. And also for the people's side as well, I think Koreans are, I think, more engaging or in a sense more demanding also towards the government, because it has an emphasis on this collective action mobilization. Also, as Abby said, has a recent experience of actually achieving this positive change of ousting this president. Whereas Japan, it could have been, it can actually be more like the Western society, which is more individualistic in a sense. It's a more mature political system in a sense. So
Monday morning meetings on migration is brought to you by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can find us on our WordPress site or alternatively on Facebook or Twitter. If you have ideas about a show that we ought to feature or a guest that we ought to have on, please contact Abby or I on imes@uva.nl.